Well, good afternoon, folks, and welcome to the Safe Kit September 21st meeting. I'm Carla Paluso, and I will call this meeting to order. So, again, welcome, everybody. It's the 21st of September already, and I am calling to order the Joint Interim Task Force on Testing of Sexual Assault Forensic Evidence Kits. Thank you for being here. Let's get started by going down the dais and introducing those who are here with us. And we'll start down at that end.
My name is Alex Gardner, and I'm the Director of the Forensics Division for State Police.
Okay. Patty Kenyon. I am the Clinical Specialist for Samaritan for SAMES.
George Burke, Deputy Chief, Salem Police.
Michelle Roland-Schwartz, Executive Director with the Oregon Attorney General Sexual Assault Task Force.
Josh Nasby with the Legislative Policy and Research Office.
And I'm Carla Paluso. I proudly represent House District 50, the great city of Gresham.
And Rod Underhill, Multnomah County's District Attorney.
And who's on the phone with us?
Sarah Gelser, State Senator from Corvallis.
Thanks.
And Danielle Tudor, Rape Survivor Advocate.
Wonderful. Anybody else on the line? Thanks, ladies. Good to have you on the phone and on the right over there.
Christy Harrington, Legislative Policy and Research Office.
Okay, thanks. And since we have a huge crowd in the audience, how about you just tell us who you are?
Okay. Thank you. My name is Mary Sophia. I am Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Lobbyist.
Thank you.
Andy Easton, representing the Oregon Hospital Association.
Wonderful. Thanks for being here. And with that, let's start with the review of the 2017 Safe Kit related legislation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the task force, Senate Bill 960 was the result of discussions at the previous task force meetings involving the definition of anonymous kits that's found in Melissa's law. The bill created an objective test that turns on whether the victim has participated in the making of a police report. A kit is classified as anonymous if the victim has not participated in making a police report, and conversely, if they have participated in making a police report, the kit is classified as non-anonymous. The bill also made clear that law enforcement agencies are required to classify a kit as non-anonymous and submit it for testing within 14 days if a victim who previously did not participate in making a police report subsequently chooses to do so. So that was Senate Bill 960. The other bill is Senate Bill 795. That legislation addressed sexual assault medical assessments and requires the provider of the assessment or a law enforcement officer to contact a victim advocate and make reasonable efforts to have the advocate present at the facility during the assessment. The bill makes clear that the decision to engage with the advocate lies with the victim and that the victim can decline the services of the advocate at any time. And for discussion purposes, I also wanted to point out that for adult victims, Senate Bill 795 requires contact with the advocate to be made in accordance with the protocols of the county's sexual assault response team. So if anyone wants to discuss either of these bills in greater detail, please feel free to do so. But I did want to attempt to segue into the sexual assault response team efficacy report that is uploaded to OLIS for today's meeting. And so with the chair's permission, I'd like to hand off to Ms. Roland-Schwartz to talk about that report in greater detail.
That will be fine.
Great. Thank you, Josh. So the Sexual Assault Task Force participated in a research project with the Sexual Violence Justice Institute that is located within the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. And their project really looked at SART mandates across the country. And the impact of those SART mandates. They asked us essentially to come up with a list of people across the state of Oregon that they could survey, interview, and wanted to get a sample of people who were part of the mandate and the development of the law, and then folks that are currently participating on SARTs and kind of what the aftermath of that was. And so we provided them with a list of people, and they interviewed them and came up with this report that Josh has loaded up onto OLIS for everyone. I'm not going to read through it. I will say that one of the findings, among the findings, included the impact on the growth of SARTs. In some communities, there were already robust SARTs, sexual assault response teams, occurring in those counties. and others, this really kind of helped foster the development of people getting together and meeting and talking about their policies, protocols, and procedures for responding to sexual assault cases. One of the challenges that they heard and frustrations from some folks was that there wasn't obviously funding that followed the mandate, and that was challenging for some communities, particularly some of our rural and frontier communities where resources are limited. So that was one of the challenges that came up and that people voiced in the research project. The other was recognizing the need to have multiple multidisciplinary partners at the table, including advocates, and their role in participating in the response to sexual assault cases. And one of many reasons why we wanted to move forward Senate Bill 795 this last session. So the report is there. Folks are welcome to take a look at it. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer to the best of my ability.
Questions, comments?
Maybe, Chair, if I might, maybe
yes.
A comment. I think these are both Senate Bill 960 and 795 are great additions to the to the work that this group is working on. And when we, not just as a group, but when we individually go back to our jurisdictions and our kind of day-to-day obligations. Relative to Senate Bill 960, there were a lot of conversations after the passage of Melissa's law that had us, a lot of us, having desire to kind of make this modification. I think some of the genesis of Senate Bill 960 actually occurred at this table and under your kind of watchful eye, if I might say, Chair. And so I appreciate that, because we were able to bring that issue up. We were able to a little bit perfect the language and get, maybe if it wasn't unanimous, it was certainly consensus support of moving in that direction, and ultimately now it has become law, and I think it's a very valuable modification to Melissa's law to help make that even more perfect of a law going forward. So thank you.
Any other comments or questions? All right. And we've had someone join us. If you'll just say, introduce yourselves, please.
I'm sorry. I'm Deanna Horn. I'm the OCDLA representative on this task force. And I'm forever underestimating Portland traffic.
You never can get it right, so don't worry about it. We all have experienced that, so we're just glad you're here. So with that, again, is there any additional discussion around the 2017 legislation or sexual assault response teams? Hearing none. Let's see, how about the next item on the agenda is an update on the safe kit testing from the Oregon State Police. Captain Gardner, can you help us with that?
Absolutely, Madam Chair, thank you. So I have this report, the colorful one that's in front of all of you. I'll apologize in advance for the small font. There's a lot of information on this page, and it's displayed the best way we could think to do it, but it's not all intuitive. So if you'll bear with me for a moment, I'll try and just sort of take it from the top to the bottom and explain what each of these boxes means. If you start at the top left in the blue box with safe kits received, that's essentially a comparative pace so that you can see what the flow looks like this year compared with last year. And if you see that little number, the tiny one in the bottom corner, at the same point in 2016, we had 954 safe kits come in. So we're at 811 for the same point in the year, so our flow is down slightly. In each case, when we're looking at these metrics, there's an arrow that indicates whether the trend is up or down over the last measurement period. So if you look one box to the right, you see the 520. That shows that we have an 18% increase in the number of safe kits completed. So it shows a trend going up. It's still not adequate to meet the volume coming in the door, which leads us to the purple box on the far right there that shows that there are now 993 safe kits pending, and that's up substantially. That the only box on the top line that I haven't talked about is that sort of turquoise one that is our outsourcing reviews. In all of 2016, we had 78. That's the tiny number in the lower left corner. So far this year, we're at 265 cases. Before I go into the rest of the description on the chart, it's important to note that in, as of January of 2017, the FBI required a change in process for CODIS because we're now looking at 20 loci instead of 13. So Sorensen Labs had to make the same changes that we made. But when you go through a change in process like that, there are validation expectations, not just in terms of what we have to do to in our own lab, but also because Sorensen is a partner under these grants, we have to sort of revalidate their process. And then we have to train everybody in the lab on the new process. So if you look at the red and blue bar graph down on the bottom, not the absolute bottom, but the sort of the lower third of the page, this just compares our training time with analysis time. It's not all of the time that the folks in DNA put in the lab, but it shows month to month how their time is being allocated between training and analysis. And you see those huge, and beginning in January of 2017, there's almost no work being done. It's all training. There's that the blue section is a little bitty bump. And that's reflected in the production that you see on the bottom of the page, both in terms of the grant stat review, which is the two, the orange and the blue box on the very bottom of the page. Those show our SACE and Danny grant numbers. And you'll notice if you look January through May, the numbers are at or near zero. We consider a case done when it's through the technical review process. So there were some cases being completed because they had been started prior to this period of time and they were just finishing up with tech review. As soon as they're done with the tech review, then they're counted. There was a large backlog of pending cases in those grants that were under the old technology, both when OSP was using the older technology and when Sorensen was. So when the people got through the training, there was that chunk of cases, and we pushed them through very quickly, and that's why you see the jump in numbers in June, July, and August. returning to sort of the top third of the page, if you look at the pie chart there, that gives you a sense of what proportion of these cases are producing CODIS quality profiles. FBI sets the criteria, and they either the quality of the DNA information is either adequate or it isn't. If it's not, even if it is adequate, it has to meet other criteria before it's entered. So that shows you how those proportions divide. And I think that's it for the general overview, but I'm happy to answer questions. I let me just say this. This transition is now nearly done. We still have some vacancies now in DNA because people leave over time. Frankly, the market for people with degrees and the capability of doing DNA work is hard to compete with. We had a woman who had a PhD leave our lab for a doubling of her salary, and then shortly thereafter left for that job for another doubling, plus bonuses. So she's now working at Hillsborough for just under five times what she was getting paid by OSP. So every time such a person departs, it's going to take us about 18 months to 2 years to get somebody fully up to speed, because it takes, you know, 8 months to get them hired, and then you got to train them. So those vacancies are an efficiency sink for us. But we have turned the corner, and my guess is that we're going to see our production, our processing speed, substantially exceed what's coming in the door by early winter, if not before. We might see that as soon as November.
Excellent.
Okay. Madam Chair, could I ask a question?
Yes.
Really quick? So the turquoise box up at the top, the outsourcing reviews, those are the ones coming back from Sorensen that
yes.
You're then going back and reviewing their work?
Yes.
Okay.
And that's a short process for us.
Thank you.
Any other comments on the safe kit testing?
Well, Chair, I can maybe supplement, because there's been some talk of Sorensen, which, you know, is tied in with the Danny / Saki grant coming out of primarily Multnomah County. So I'll add to a broader picture of kind of adding that and what that what I think that translates to into what we're seeing relative to the Oregon State Police report that we're talking about. So backing up, just a quick remember or refreshing of memory. So the Danny grant pays for the testing of untested safe kits that were backlogged in three different counties, Multnomah County, Marion County, Lane County. They pay for just the testing. They don't pay for staffing or that kind of thing, but it just goes to the testing aspect. My office wrote that grant and partnered with the counties that I've mentioned, partnered with law enforcement agencies affected. A simultaneous grant was pursued by the Portland Police Bureau. That's that BJA grant, sometimes called the Saki grant. Another, at the time, $1.2 million or so that actually paid for personnel to include investigators, prosecution resources, and advocates. And so essentially the two of them were working, those two grants made a broader picture of doing body of work from a number standpoint. And that's, so with that background, number standpoint, as of September 5th, we had sent a total of 2,604 previously untested backlogged kits to the Sorenson Lab in Utah. What I don't have in front of me is that, and I'm not just not quite remembering, is that every one of them? I think the answer is yes. If it's not, there's only a modest number remaining to be sent to the lab. Of those 2,600, I'm going to round that up for a minute, and again, this is September 5th. Of those 2,600, Sorenson has actually completed the analysis of 1,839. So I don't know what percentage that is, but about two-thirds, three-fifths, right in that range, it sounds, looks like. Number of kits where no DNA, no CODIS entry, no DNA or insufficient for CODIS entry, of those 1,839, it's 1,128. Number of kits pending OSP evaluation, and I think that falls, I suspect that it falls into the far right-hand column that adds to that pending. So some of those are just going to be pending by other jurisdictions and other business in the state. But of the backlog Danny / Saki, those are 372. The number of kits with that have already been received by OSP, have been reviewed and entered into CODIS is 272. I look at this number 265, it suggests to me that mine is September 5th data, yours might be through August, or might it be is, just, yeah. You know, it's very close, so we're off by a few, probably because of the timeline of when the report was generated. Number of kits evaluated by OSP but not entered due to eligibility issues, and that answer, at least right now, is 67 as of, again, September 5th. CODIS hits, again, this is Saki Danny, CODIS hits 135. There are pending cases in our jurisdiction and one or both of the other jurisdictions relative to the translation between review, CODIS entry, hits, referral to investigative resources to, you know, to link that back up with the case, and what does it do to the historical case? And the answer is there are now a handful of cases that are in the pending trial status. But as you can see, this is a bit of a, it's a big, I don't know what the best, you know, kind of visual for it is, but it's a big loop, and these are working their way through. But by and large, most of them, almost, if not all of them, are already at Sorenson now and are in the process of working themselves back through OSP back into Oregon, so to speak. But I think we're well past the midway point. In fact, we're near the end of that process.
Excellent. Comments?
Just one quick. So in the legislative change with the new definition of an anonymous kit, right, are we going back to when the bill was first passed, Melissa's Law? And are we now capturing those that fall in that gap during that time frame? That now that we're working under a new definition?
Right. And so we're not actually working under the definition yet because it's effective on January 1st.
Right.
And so what we're doing is, when if cases in that status come to us, we're canceling the request, which basically freezes the timeline so that we're not statistically punished for taking too long to work the cases. But we're not sending them back to the agency. We're retaining them. And then when January 1st rolls around, we'll start the clock running again, and we put them through the testing process. Because under the law that exists now, we're not to test them, which is a little frustrating. Our preference would have been to just start moving them through because it would be easier to manage them one at a time instead of, you know, basically building a new backlog. But that's what we think we have to do.
So in the time from when Melissa's law was first enacted until the new laws enacted, what are we going to then, those kits that were returned, will those then be resubmitted back to OSP for analysis?
That's our expectation, because okay. The law doesn't treat those cases differently. They exist, they should be sent to us, and we'll okay. test them.
Thank you.
And that's, you know, that to kind of wrap that up and tie that up, that's a great question as it relates to all the more reason and the primary motivation for this body, this group, to work toward having Melissa's law changed and modified that area. But for Senate Bill 960's passage, as you heard, we would be accumulating the next, call it, generation's backlog of safe kits. And so we've got this modest accumulation, but a planful approach of it by the Oregon State Police so that that doesn't develop into a backlog, but instead of just a, we'll call it, temporary backlog. And then day forward, beginning in January, with the 960 language, we should have essentially eliminated future backlog. That's the hope, at least.
So I think the important part there will be the communication back to law enforcement agencies so that they're well aware that that submission should occur so that we don't end up with a one-year, one-and-a-half-year now new backlog that people are unaware of until we become aware of it.
Yeah, that's a good point. And we are actually producing a quarterly newsletter now, and I've spoken to Kevin Campbell, who can put information out through the Chiefs and Sheriffs Association. So we'll have a couple of bites at a couple of chances to cycle the information through.
Perfect. Thank you.
Sure.
Okay. Yes.
I just want to pick up on that thread. I had a conversation with one of the task force members earlier this week via email that was concerned about pre-Melissa's law. Kits. And the conversation we had was, my understanding is OSP conducted an audit at the very initial, when the problem first arose, to sort of get a handle on how many kids were out in the local jurisdictions. And I saw the other day, I'll just note that I saw the other day the Secretary of State has safe kits on their audit list for 2017, 2018. So my expectation is there is an audit coming. But the question, as I understood it from the task member, or the task force member, was, how do we know that all of the pre-Melissa's law kits were sent to the state police?
Well, I think, unless I'm wrong, I think the answer is they weren't. For sure, right? Because
as I've explained to folks, OSP doesn't have access to every agency's evidence inventory, so the expectation is that the agencies are sending us the evidence, and I can't think of any reason why they wouldn't, because most of them wouldn't want to be holding all that stuff that could potentially be useful. But we don't have the information. I can't tell you Portland Police Bureau had this many cases and sent us this many. We know what they sent us and what we did with it once we got it, but that's it.
Can I interject a question here? This is Danielle.
Yes, go ahead.
I was the task force member that was trying to get some clarification. Dorothy Hart had reached out to me and asked about Melissa's law, and as we know with Melissa's law, moving forward on the statewide basis, all kits are to be submitted, but it's pre-Melissa's law. We know in certain counties, you know, like Multnomah, Lane, and Marion County, that kits from those counties in the backlog are being submitted. So the question, I guess, that was posed to me was, what about the rest of the counties in the state? Are they also being mandated to test their backlog? And I've reached out to a couple of DAs to find out. I reached out to Bob Berman and John Foote just to see what they were doing. And I got the sense that they're kind of working on theirs,
but there's this uncertainty, I guess. Is everyone in the state required to test their backlog? I think that pretty much is the question, or was it just certain counties?
So this is Rod Underhill. Danielle, it's a great question that I believe I know the answer to, but I actually encourage all of us, and I think I will, double check what I'm about to say, because I don't want to be wrong on it. So Melissa's law is essentially a day forward piece of legislation. It is not a historical backlog. It does not address a methodology, manner, or mandate to address backlogged, untested kits. It's a day forward. So what does that translate to? What that translates to, in other words, relative to the OSP numbers, it's a, you know, they're a little cloudy, but it's in the neighborhood of 5,000 back when that analysis was done. It's about 5,000 spread around the entire state. The three counties that I have mentioned, Multnomah, Lane, and Marion, made up about half of that accumulated backlog. Multnomah County made up about 1,800 of the 5,000. So nothing in the law mandated anybody to do backlog work. That was, I'll just say it, I'm looking at George Burke, that was Rod Underhill, George Burke, chiefs of police, and the sheriff in Multnomah County getting together when I learned of that number. We were all simultaneously becoming aware of the backlog number. We met and determined that we were going to address this unacceptable backlog under our watch, and we went about pursuing resources to do it. But that was grant funding through Danny and BJA, not mandated, not by law, and it preceded Melissa's law by several months. We got to work on it.
Right.
So what that means from a number standpoint, and again, these are, I'm just doing kind of quick math and it's a little bit loose math, but what that translates to is out of the 5,000, 2,600 of the backlog states cases have now essentially either been addressed or in the process of being tested and reviewed. That quick math tells us that's about 2,400 of untested backlogged kits that remain in the other 33 counties. Where exactly, I don't know. I'm just going by memory, and probably the state police probably has some of that, at least a rough cut at where those are. Is there a law that mandates those cases? Mandates, meaning shall test those 2,400 kits wherever you are in the state. And I think the answer is no. I don't think Melissa's law does that. Melissa's law eliminates the day forward notion of a backlog as we move forward. So, it's a great question, Mr. Nasby, because I actually was going to opine at some point, all right, what's our next step? Resource, considerations need to be made because OSP continues to be resource impacted by all this conversation. But we have 2,400 backlog cases that I'd like to see our state be what may be the first state in the country to have a backlog-free state. We're more than halfway in what has turned out to be a short turnaround, right? When we started this grant process, we are more than halfway. There's 2,400 or so left. What can we do next?
And Rod will probably fall out of his chair when I say this, but I don't really think it's the DA's responsibility for those kits. I think those are housed within law enforcement agencies, and we really need to focus on law enforcement moving forward and how do we as a law enforcement community help make that happen. Obviously the DAs can help influence that, but the DAs don't have access to the police evidence rooms, and so it's really law enforcement's responsibility to work on moving that forward.
I don't.
So the reason, you know, I think we all probably know Joyful Heart does have their six pillars of what they want to see in every state. And as they're looking at Oregon, there's a couple areas that they are looking at. And one of them is They are looking at maybe possible legislation in the short session to mandate the testing across the state, whatever is left, if it's that 2,400. What does that look like to us to do that? Is that something that's even possible then?
Is it possible? Yeah, I've written a blank check in my head, which helps me to more easily say, yes, I think a law can be written. How does it get paid for? And, of course, we'd want to, you know, the better way to do it is, as Chief Deputy Burke pointed out, you know, we want, you know, broader law enforcement support of this, right? These kits literally reside in police agencies and sheriffs, you know, around the state, in all but effectively three counties now, as far as the backlog goes, by and large. And so the best methodology would be that conversation in a robust way happens in that forum with law enforcement. I agree with George that prosecutors may not have primary responsibility over it, but we certainly have a shared responsibility. I certainly saw it that way. I know we worked well together, and it was Alex Gardner, who was the district attorney of Lane County, when I picked up the phone and I said, you know, essentially, Alex, here's what we got. We're working on the safe kit backlog, and you've got about, at the time we thought it was about 400. You want to work together and let's clear these out. And I Reader's Digest that conversation, but the answer was without hesitancy, yes. It's a partnership, and that's how it should be viewed.
Well, looking at the numbers on the sheet that you have there from OSP, it appears to me that you do have counties that are submitting kits from their backlog that aren't mandated to do so, unless I'm reading that sheet wrong, and that's just something on the current level to do with some of those counties and not from the backlog. But in my conversation with Bob Herman, he actually, I don't have it in front of me, but he actually gave me numbers as to where they are, and they're Washington County. And John Foote was going to do some checking to see where they were. So it almost strikes me that we do have counties that are still moving forward with their backlog, even though they haven't been mandated to do so. Would that be correct?
That's my understanding. This is Alex Gardner speaking, and that's my understanding with respect to Washington County. We've been getting some of their backlog, or I can't tell you what proportion of their backlog we have, but that explains that spike that you see on the graph.
Okay.
So maybe rather than...
No.
I'm sorry, Danielle. Maybe rather than looking at a legislative fix, maybe this is a policy discussion between OACP and OSSA to really start focusing on what we can do about backlogs in our inventory and really focus on the policy side of that.
Yeah, I would think so, because I don't want to create a hardship in what we already have going. I do want to see us be, as Rod said, maybe that first state that's got it all done and under control. But yet I want to be reasonable with our resources and what we can actually do. And I'm sure you all realize that as a rape survivor, my first thing would be, yes, we need to have all those kits tested and move forward with that, but yet there has to be that reasonable side of what we can do, and I'm not sure, as far as this legislation, if we're ready for that or if we should wait until the long session. So definitely, I'll see some of you in October there in Portland, and maybe I'll set up some discussions on that, and Joyful Heart will be there at that time as well.
Thank you. Any other comments?
Just another idea to probably throw out. So sometimes it is the best avenue to have a law that mandates things such as this, the clearing of a backlog, for example, right? That's what we're talking about. And sometimes, like what I think occurred in Multnomah County, Lane County, and Marion County, which was a voluntary desire to, we want to do this. We're going to do it on our own. We don't need a law to tell us to do this.
Right.
We've got 2,400 kits left or so, right, in the state. And I think we'd like to encourage at least a moment of opportunity for law enforcement to have a conversation about where are they on volunteering. They'd need to, you know, I'd encourage, you know, the involvement of Oregon State Police to look at resource capacity and work out a, do we have a voluntary plan that doesn't require us to go seek a law in this area? Because it would be a, effectively, it will be a law that would be valuable, but only temporary, right? Once the backlog is cleared,
right,
it's cleared. Can we try this voluntary request first as opposed to feeling we need to pursue a law
right
first?
Right.
And from my perspective,
I would agree, yeah.
And from my perspective and the notes that I've been taking, I'm wondering if we can perhaps gather a subgroup of this group to perhaps look at that, or to not necessarily create an official policy, but at least some guidelines to make that happen. Is that?
Sure, yeah.
That might be a good idea. And then that way, you know, when requests come in, hey, have you guys, you know, what are you going to do with the rest of that backlog? If we've got a statement that explains how we got to where we are, which is, as was stated, it pretty much there was no law that mandated us to. We went after it and did it. So we would like to have that same opportunity, you know, with the rest of it, that is our intention without having to have a law.
So, Josh, perhaps I could work with you and we can maybe bring something forward along those lines. Because I think OSP is busy enough with the existing backlog that if we can alleviate a little of that, that's going to sort of speed their process up ideally, as well as, again, put some sort of parameters in place to get up to speed to where we've eliminated it, mm-hmm, the backlog.
Right. Yes, and you know, we have at least an idea of what it's going to cost, mm-hmm, because the numbers, the 2,600 that we
right
addressed, you know, it cost, I'm going to use round numbers, it used up all of the $2 million of the Danny grant to outsource those to Sorensen to help offset some implications, not a lot, but some, to the Oregon State Police in a modest amount. But we can fairly assume, I haven't got an updated, but I think in broad brush strokes, another 2,500, if that's the actual number. Well, you're looking at another $2 million of testing money. And then you've got investigative implications to those court-based things. You know, just there's a number of collateral matters to address. But we've got a template for what the cost may be as we bring this conversation to Chiefs of Police, Sheriff's Association, and began to attempt to see what their capacity is, mm-hmm, for exploring voluntary addressing of this.
Well, and I also think it's important that we do. I think somewhere it was talked about that there are some agencies who do not have access to the rape kits, or I'm not saying it right, but I'm trying to figure it out from my notes that are quite scribbly. But
we don't. The state police doesn't have access to their data. Their inventory control. But I think they, I, as Rod has suggested, I'm confident they'd be willing to help and
sure
be good partners. And so what I'd suggest is maybe I can reach out to the Chiefs Association and the Sheriff's Association and ask if they could sort of put a group together to give us the numbers so we can confirm what the size of the workload is.
I think that's a very good idea.
Early November, Law Enforcement Leadership Forum, which is a combination of folks from OACP and OSSA, will be gathering and we'll be talking about some of these things moving forward. I'm more than happy to bring that up with Kevin and the group if you guys would like me to do that. It kind of gets the discussion started, and then yeah,
that would be great.
Okay.
I see heads nodding. So that's
nobody objecting.
Nobody's objecting.
Yeah, and I volunteer to. I'll leave it to you guys. We've got a good finger on the pulse of what you just said. I don't need to repeat it, but if I can be of any assistance, to include coming down for an hour or so dialogue at the leadership conference that you're talking about, just let me know.
Okay. Thanks.
Great.
So any other discussion around that? All right, then we will move to the next item on the agenda, which is access to care and Senate Bill 842. Josh, a brief overview, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the task force. Senate Bill 842 did not become law this session. And the bill was nearly identical to House Bill 3303, which is the next item on the agenda. For now, I just want to focus on the provision that's in 842 and not in 3303. And we can pick up the rest of this at the subsequent conversation. So the one provision that is significant in 842 that's not in 3303 would have required all hospitals with an emergency department to perform sexual assault medical assessments. And the one thing I wanted to do, just to provide a little bit of context that I think is relevant to both of these bills. In 2011, the Assembly adopted Senate Bill 557, the provisions of which are codified at ORS 147-401 and 147-403, lots of numbers. The former statute directs district attorneys to organize the SARTs that we previously discussed, and the latter statute requires medical facilities to adopt policies for the, quote, treatment or referral of acute sexual assault patients, end quote. And additionally, for those facilities that do perform sexual assault medical exams, ORS 147-403 requires that the facility adopt specific medical guidelines and establishes a general rule that these facilities must employ or contract with a trained sexual assault nurse examiner. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Certainly. So with that, I'm going to ask Ms. Roland Schwartz and Ms. Kenyon to begin the discussion.
Thank you, Chair. So, Patty, you want me to go ahead and get started?
Go ahead.
And then, all right,
I'll chime
sounds
in.
Great. Thank you. So I was asked to come and talk a little bit today about, and we're here obviously to talk about the backlog, but on the other side of that is how do victims of sexual assault get access to medical forensic care? And speaking broadly about medical forensic care, which includes the sexual assault forensic evidence kit. And so access to care is something that the task force has been talking about and trying to remedy for quite some time. This is an issue not only in Oregon, but an issue nationally in victims trying to get access to a trained sexual assault nurse examiner or other forensic examiner to provide them with comprehensive health care and collect evidence. So to that end, the task force has a number of programs to kind of get at that issue. And I've given you kind of a written overview of our activities to attempt to remedy this issue. So the Oregon SANE program, our sexual assault nurse examiner program, we have a three-quarter time SANE coordinator at the task force who provides technical assistance and training to not only forensic examiners across the state, but clinics and hospitals across the state of Oregon. Within that, our SANE coordinator provides administrative support to the Oregon SANE Certification Commission, and that is established in rule. There are specific seats that are filled within the commission, and what they do is review SANE certification applications. And I'll go into that a little bit more later because I think there's confusion about whether or not a SANE can actually practice without certification, and there's some confusion around that I'd like to clear up. In addition, we provide through our Sexual Assault Training Institute the 40-hour didactic training that is required for a registered nurse to be able to provide medical forensic care to this particular population. And that is for adult adolescent patients only. We do not provide the 40-hour didactic pediatric exam. That's outside of our scope. And so our focus is really on adult adolescent care. We also provide training for mock exams and mock trials, which are part of SANE's clinical training requirements and help them actually work towards becoming certified. Some of the challenges that we've recognized across the state is really the ability for communities to build capacity and sustain SANE programs in their county, and it is impacted by a number of issues. One, most of the SANEs across the state, this is not something that they do as their full-time job. They are working in an emergency department. They're working in maternal health. Help me out, Patty.
Any type of subspecialty,
yes. And as long as they're an eligible provider, they can go through the training. But this is really a specialty that most often they're doing on the side. And so if they're in the emergency department, for instance, working a shift, and a sexual assault patient comes in for medical forensic care, they're pulled off of the floor to provide that, you know, sometimes up to 6-hour medical forensic exam. And so there are a lot of issues just in terms of providing support for our SANEs in our communities and recognizing that this, for most, is not a full-time job. The other issue that we run into is that often when we think of medical forensic care and when we think of victims when they're coming in, we're often focused only on the evidence, and which is obviously necessary to get, you know, to move forward in the criminal justice process. But when we're talking with members of sexual assault response teams, with hospitals, the idea that that what is happening in that room is someone is swabbing and collecting evidence, what is actually happening is this comprehensive health assessment and discharge planning and looking at the overall health and well-being of the person in front of them. And so we're often kind of battling this idea that that the person walking in is only there to get evidence collection. And so that impacts policies, that impacts the SANEs in specifically in our rural and frontier regions, where they may be one of three SANEs, or they may be the only SANE, and there's not necessarily an understanding of what their role is, and that multidisciplinary support. And so that's something else that we are trying to address and provide some education around so that we can sustain their practice, so that they're not burning out, and all of those issues that come up. Some of the other issues that we see is, what is the economic condition of the community? What is the impact of the infrastructure of the county in being able to support access to health care? If you're having trouble with other specialties being present in terms of health care, there is definitely this added challenge of recruiting and retaining SANEs in the community. And so I'll give an example. A couple of the training efforts that the task forces move forward on, I would say about 2013, we started planning to write for a federal OVW rural project, and we're successful in getting funding. And it's a 3-year project that allows us to focus our training and capacity building efforts in a few regions in the state. And that, in terms of cities, is Brookings and Gold Beach down on the southern coast of Oregon, and then in LeGrand, Pendleton, and Hermiston. And we've been working with those communities to identify providers and train them, work with the advocacy programs. In fact, it's a requirement in our grant that we contract with and work with the community-based advocacy programs. And so that limited the counties that we really could look at, because we had to identify counties where the community-based advocacy programs responded. So the example I'd like to share is, in one of those communities, we had identified a group of SANEs, and it's small because we didn't expect 30 people to sign up for the training. But when the training came around, the majority of those medical providers who were interested in attending the training no longer lived in the county. And so we could have gone through that training and then, you know, 6 months later, been right back where we started. And so I'm pleased to say that we are continuing to work with the hospital, with the sexual assault response team, to identify what kind of recruitment and training plan we can have in that county so that we can keep those providers there. But it is very much a challenge. Among the other issues that we identify in terms of access to care and maintaining SANEs in communities is just their ability to practice, the number of cases that are coming into the hospital. So to practice as a SANE, as I said, you have to go through the 40-hour training, and that is a requirement from the Oregon State Board of Nursing, and I've provided that their interpretive statement here for you just so you can see. At one point, you could have a registered nurse who had not gone through the 40-hour training provide care, but that changed with this OSBN rule. And so we have a very limited number of people that are eligible to provide that service. When they're not practicing, they're not necessarily able to demonstrate, they have difficulty demonstrating their competency and feeling confident in providing that care. So we received, through the department, Oregon Department of Justice, a VOCA grant that will allow us to go to rural and frontier regions across the state. And we're in the process of doing that to provide some of the mock exam training, help them with their clinical skills development. And then in conjunction with that, we received around $20,000 from VOCA and the Office of Victims of Crime to help us provide scholarships to send sexual assault nurse examiners to approved clinical sites in the country so that they can go and be with other SANEs and walk through mock exams and get that additional experience. So there's a lot of investment in terms of going into trying to support SANEs in their practice, and we still have a lot of challenges that are very unique to each county in the state, and not a lot of resources to support that process, and resources in terms of funding and people. As I said, our SANE coordinator is three-quarter time, so. I don't know if you want to add anything, Patty.
Sure. So in terms of a nurse being trained to be a sexual assault nurse examiner, first and foremost, she has to have buy-in by her medical facility. And that is very hard to find in rural communities. When you look at a hospital that has trouble staffing the hospital with nurses, let alone sending them to training for exams that happen in some critical access hospitals 3 to 5 times a year. And when I was doing a proposal for our facility to develop a standalone clinic, I figured that it cost $10,000 to certify a nurse, because it's not just covering sending them to the 40-hour training. That's great if you have a scholarship. But it's also going back and doing the additional roughly 100 to 120 hours to be certified. And typically, you have to pay another nurse to help with that certification. And I hear from many, many nurses around the state where they are not reimbursed. This is all on their own dime to become certified. And if you're a single parent and have lack of resources, it's impossible. And one of the hospitals that I work with frequently says, yes, you can do that exam, but you have to return back with it for your next shift, which may be in 4 hours by the time you complete an exam. And obviously that puts other patients at risk. So there's the whole component of training in and getting the support by the hospital. As Michelle said, until we see this as a health care intervention, we will never have buy-in from the hospital, because I hear over and over from multiple facilities, and I've been doing this for 40 years, so this part hasn't changed, where getting a kid, that's something for the cops to do. It is not considered something that hospitals should be responsible for, gathering evidence. That puts it in a legal realm, not in a healthcare intervention. So until we see this as providing health care for this person, and then when I do an exam, I rarely do I hear somebody say, I want evidence collected. It's, am I okay? I want to make sure I didn't catch anything. That's what people come in for. It's not to get the person. When you know the dynamics of sexual assault, you know most often it's somebody they know. So they're not there to put that person that they know very well sometimes in jail. So it is imperative that we start to see this as a healthcare intervention, and when you're doing the exam and working with that person and listening to them and providing crisis intervention, that they then say, yes, I do want to have some evidence collected so my options are open later. And many times by the end of the exam, they are now saying, I do want to talk to the police. I do want to go forward with something. So if you have a nurse that is properly trained and have the time to spend with that patient, which is 4, 6, sometimes 8 hours, that's when you start to have buy-in into the criminal justice system. Until that, if you're not working with somebody that knows their options, knows what the laws are, payment of the sexual assault exam, that your patient, for me, a patient is never going to go forward with this process. And we can collect all kinds of kits, but until you have a strong survivor, victim, patient, whatever label we're going to use, that person is not going to want to go forward. They're not going to commit to this process.
Senator Thatcher.
Was there any discussion of, and I might be using the term incorrectly, mm-hmm. of telemedicine, not saying long distance healthcare, but somebody to support the nurse that may not be fully trained yet, just mm-hmm. to kind of bridge some of these gaps out there?
So telesane is alive and well in many parts of the country. And it can, a telesane program can cross state lines. It's personally, I think that is something that this state should look at very strongly. I can teach somebody how to do a swab. That is very easy. But how to talk to the person, have the time, and many ERs will say, well, the doctor can do it. Well, that means stopping all patient flow in an ER for those that only have one physician on. And if you have multiple physicians, it still slows down the process and puts other patients at risk.
And I would add, we also see when you have someone who's had the training and has both feet firmly planted in healthcare, the evidence that is collected is better and the outcomes are better. And so we don't necessarily want to halt everything in the hospital and have somebody do that who hasn't necessarily had the training. And then in terms of thinking about it as a healthcare issue, it's not only the hospitals that we're wanting to see that, it's all of the multidisciplinary partners. Because I've heard my fellow advocates, I've heard, you know, law enforcement that I've worked with and many others kind of why is this taking so long? We just need to do a swab. And my own discipline has done that as well. And so it's really reframing this issue, as you said, Patty, a healthcare issue.
When I was originally trained 40 years ago, I was always taught that this was a psychiatric emergency. And not because they were mentally ill at the time, but to prevent future mental health problems. And we know that patients who have been sexually assaulted frequently go on to have further health care problems. Some of them mentally, many of them physical health care problems. So it's imperative that they are cared for properly.
One of the things that I would like to add is a couple of things that we're doing at the Sexual Assault Task Force. One, I think many of you here know, we have a subcommittee structure. We're 100 Oregonians who volunteer their time to serve on the Sexual Assault Task Force. And so three of our subcommittees, our medical forensic, our victim response, and legislative and public policy, have been working over the past several months to come up with a survey that we're sending out to multidisciplinary providers across the state just to hear about what's happening. What happens when you're with a victim and they're going to get a medical forensic exam? You know, how long is the wait time? What are transfer policies, et cetera? And so we anticipate having some of those results back by the end of the year. The other is working with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems to develop a webcast for hospital administrators to talk about not only the SART mandate, but the requirement for hospitals to either have a SANE on staff or contract with one. And so I think in terms of getting that buy-in from the hospitals across the state, I think we're moving in that direction, and I'm really excited for that partnership, because I think it will help get us in that direction, and also exploring some of the telesane programs as well. Again, that comes with resources and you know, somebody writing the grant and us kind of thinking about how to implement that. But it certainly is something that we're talking about and looking into.
Excellent. Any thoughts?
Yes.
Yeah, quick thoughts woven in with questions, maybe. As you were describing this, it made me think of what I think is a fairly well-designed system in this area that deals with child abuse and child sexual assault. So you have MDTs, right, statutory MDTs, multidisciplinary teams around the 36 counties, not unlike the SARTs. But what I think is missing in the SART continuum as it relates to this is a funding stream that the MDTs in child abuse arena have with respect to access to CAMI money, right? What is CAMI money? Child abuse multidisciplinary intervention resources, right? Quite literally money that is provided to the counties. It is the MDTs are made up of groups, not unlike this conversation where you come up with where should we use our local jurisdictions CAMI dollars, and at least in Multnomah County, I think shared experiences around the state, but certainly in Multnomah County, a significant amount of those CAMI dollars go to our CARES. That's our forensic assessment examination hospital. It's a conglomeration of hospitals where children are brought for their all of what you've described, right? Mm-hmm. That are between the ears things that are very, very important for a young child and an adult victim of sexual assault, together with their physical medical needs, together with evidentiary concerns and such, right? But as I was listening to it, I was thinking to myself, not unlike so many other things, resources and a consistent resource methodology, so that there's reliance, both, it's not just a one-year grant, a two-year grant where it's unreliable foundationally, but long-term. And so, anyway, there is the structure in place, meaning the SART structure. What's not in place is the funding resource structure. And should we at least explore the notion of taking the CAMI model, the child abuse multidisciplinary intervention model of funding, replicate it and customize it as it relates to this conversation in adults?
And I would think that would be very, very good. I hear the same problems, though, around care for children in the rural and frontier. It works great in the Portland metropolitan area. Outside of Portland metropolitan area, it's very difficult to find examiners for children after hours in that acute phase. Again, the same people that work on the MDT in rural areas also work on the SARTs.
So how do you close that gap? I don't experience that
money.
Personally.
Money.
I don't have an idea to remedy what you're thinking of, but maybe you do.
And I'll tell you what, from my experience, CARES doesn't see kids on an emergent basis. There's that appointment is getting scheduled later.
Right.
Yes.
So they're not seeing them
emergently.
In the ER. In the emergency department.
Right now, by an injury.
They're not. They're examining subsequent injuries
the child in emergency care will go to...
Historical.
Yeah, they'll go to the hospital in the emergency room and go through that system and be referred to CARES. But there's still, but the hospitals, at least for us, and I concede that in Portland, we're a little bit spoiled relative to access to resources in this area. But the CARES program is, they get the hospitals, Legacy and Providence and beyond together and organized to weave in the, what does the emergency response look like as it's a soft, warm handoff to the CARES program for subsequent more, a different angled aspect of assessing the child's health as well as conversations about what happened to you. Right? I'm seeing this as a doctor. How did this occur? It's a bifurcated problem. One, resources. Two, are there people to spend the resources on if you had them? But it's a little bit of cart and horse, right? There's some of it is determines the other. Mm-hmm. Because I'm not in a rural county, I don't have as creative ideas to, all right, how do you figure out that part of it?
It's not just a rural county thing. I was on the board of Kids First for many years, which is the Child Forensic Center down in Eugene. And we basically had, we benefited from having a nurse practitioner and a longtime pediatrician who took it upon themselves to get the additional training, which is a significant undertaking. It's a real commitment. Mm-hmm. And then in the case of the most recent pediatrician, when I was still on the board, she had to get the buy-in from her partners in her medical group because she was away from the practice so much of the time. So it really is a significant financial sacrifice. And our center benefited from the state funding pieces, but most of the money had to be donated. It was a constant fundraising effort, mm-hmm. And it was never adequate. So the amount of money that was paid to the nurse practitioner and the physician who were there was a small fraction of what their time was worth. So it's a heavy lift to get the money that it would take to provide stability and continuity.
Yeah. Well, just to say it because it's accurate, that's the experience up at CARES Northwest as well, is they are they are not operating on CAMI dollars alone. It is a multi-layered contribution of different, fundraisers and different grants and hospitals supporting just kind of out of their own infrastructure and contributions. So certainly, it's a little bit of, there's a gap. You've talked about it. What's the answer, right? What's the remedy? It's not the remedy to develop a consistent, reliable funding stream, but it's part of the remedy, isn't it? Because you have to have training dollars. You have to offset that, as Alex, as you've just said, when somebody leaves, there is a resource implication to the hospital. Can it be mitigated through the functional equivalent of CAMI dollars, and can those things be worked out? A lot of work to be done in that area.
You keep the Saints from Pendleton and moving to Portland.
Yes.
Keep the Saints in the rural communities, yes. Yeah. And if I could just kind of go back to the proposed bill, I think in some communities that, people were really enthusiastic about that because it would have solved some issues that they were experiencing. And I think there were concerns in other communities about, okay, if we have this mandate but we don't have SANEs, what does it mean to have someone who isn't trained, who's an eligible medical provider but isn't necessarily trained? What does that do in terms of the victim's experience and the quality of the evidence and the outcome of the case? And so those were some of the things that we were hearing from folks around the state. I'm really looking forward to working with the Hospital Association because I think, this may be new information and that there is potential for collaboration there to really look at what are some of the policies, what are policies around SANEs who are providing exams, and can we provide some relief you know, maybe they not have to come in to work the next day, those sorts of remedies that I think we can at least help with some of that retention and sustainability so that we're not burning our lone saints out working in those really small communities. But.
And I can tell you, I volunteer with the International Association of Forensic Nursing on the Government Affairs Committee. And there are presently two bills being introduced in Congress to mandate hospitals have SANEs. But again, there's no dollars associated with it. There have, in the proposed budget, there is funding that has been proposed for nurses or for to train SANEs. However, it states that that will go towards advanced practice or nurse practitioners. And nurse practitioners have their own clients, their own schedules, and I can tell you that is not it's not where the funding needs to be, should be.
Anything further on this topic?
I just want to say that
sure.
I guess I feel like I have a sort of an unusual position on this task force, and I guess it's kind of it mirrors I guess my job in the criminal justice system, which is I'm essentially I guess like a quality control expert, and that I want to make sure that people like George and Alex are doing their jobs right, and that Rod's bringing cases that. You know, as he can bring and those he can prove, and I know he doesn't want to do that, but I can see that there's a real interest on behalf of the criminal defense bar to make sure that what the evidence that we're getting is accurate. I mean, and that goes to testing too, to make sure that we're actually testing things accurately, and nothing scares me more than an innocent client, and I don't want Rod to be prosecuting them that way. So I
nor
see.
Does he.
Yeah, right. I know he doesn't. And so I think maybe sometimes in the criminal justice system we end up spending money in the wrong places, where if we're spending them on the front end to make sure that women that are coming into the hospitals are treated properly and that evidence is collected properly and that they're counseled properly, that we're weeding out things that we don't need to deal with. And we're dealing only with the things that we do need to be dealing with. And so that maybe money spent on that front end is way, way better than spending it later in wasted investigative resources, paying a public defender, Rod using the resources of his office. So, yeah, that's my pitch for quality assurance in the system. And I see SANEs as really a part of that kind of quality assurance.
No, I think that was helpful to be heard.
Thanks.
Okay, thank you. So next up, if there's no further discussion on that, let's talk about safe kit retention and collection timelines and House Bill 3303. Josh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I mentioned earlier, there's a lot of duplication between 3303 and 842. So I think everything I'm about to talk about in 3303 is also in 842, just FYI. So 3303 would have required hospitals to have a protocol that ensures compliance with Melissa's law. And it also would have required that hospitals properly store safe kits for at least 60 days after collection. And I thought I'd just sort of briefly remind everyone of the timelines contained in Melissa's law. So that legislation requires the medical facilities to notify law enforcement within 7 days. It provides law enforcement with an additional 7 days to collect the kit, and then requires the agency to submit the kit to the state police within 14 days after taking possession of the kit. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. So how about Michelle and Patty? You want to talk a little bit about that?
Thank you, Chair. I think folks are probably done hearing me speak, so I'm going to try and keep it brief. I was asked just to come and talk about the task force recommendation in terms of when kits are picked up. And then I think, Patty, you were going to talk a little bit about the 60-day, holding the kits for 60 days, and then medical records retention, yes? Mm-hmm. So make sure I'm not So one of the conversations that we've been having with the Sexual Assault Task Force within our Criminal Justice Subcommittee is the pickup of kits following the medical forensic exam. And I know within Melissa's law there was built in that 7-day time frame for notification and for law enforcement to pick up evidence kits. And as I recall in testimony, that was to get at some of our more rural frontier areas where there may not be somebody immediately available to come pick up the kit. We wanted to update our recommendation post Melissa's law, and part of that conversation was really having this recommendation that the kit be picked up as quickly as possible following the exam, just to maintain integrity of any specimens that are collected. They are still deliberating on the 4 to 24 hour pickup, and I think our steering committee is going to be looking at that later this year to have a full vote, and then we'll publish our recommendations. But I'll just say that that's about the time frame that folks are talking about, is the 4 to 24 hour, to pick it up as quickly as possible after the exam, just to preserve the integrity of specimens. And I'll let you talk a little bit more about that, because you do that on a daily basis. I don't.
So I think, so when I work in Portland at the various hospitals, some hospitals have a procedure in place to be able to lock up evidence. I only know of one other hospital than the one that I work in that has a refrigerator they can lock to put biological specimens in, urine, blood. Nobody that I'm aware of outside of where I work has a specific evidence room. So we're talking of making it a requirement for hospitals to then develop a safe storage space, which sounds great, except that Environmental Services has access to any locked areas, all the security people have evidence. It would be really difficult in any hospital to have evidence stored where there is not multiple people possibly having access to it. So the shorter the time period, the better. And that's to maintain that chain of custody, make sure that evidence is properly stored. So again, keeping that evidence secure would be a problem in most facilities. And again, if you're talking to a hospital that does 3 exams a year, that's a lot of money to put out when you're trying to buy a defibrillator for the heart attacks that come in every other day. That's the kind of choices we're talking about in hospitals. As far as medical records, so right now, some facilities have allowed the SANES to put a copy of their record inside the kit. Some do not, because it is seen as a violation, a HIPAA violation, the protecting their personal health information. For any facility, medical records are held on to for 10 years past the last time that they are seen. So in the area that I work at, so for students at Oregon State, they're seen at the hospital, and then they move on with their lives and they're not seen. Those records are destroyed. In some areas, that may mean that there is no record to go with that kit. And yes, you've got the DNA, but particularly if it's an anonymous kit, there may not be a record of what has happened. And that's a real issue, I think, when we're talking about storing kits or DNA. We can prosecute up to 25 years, I believe. But it's a problem. If you don't know what happened and that nurse is long gone or deceased, or you don't have access to them, there's no way of other than
And not all facilities allow photos to be taken, and those photos may be deleted at the same time. So there may, you may have a kit, but you have no history to go with that current or history that was taken at the time of the exam. So that is another problem. And when we're talking, you know, hospitals making the decision of, are we going to store them electronically, are we going to store them as paper, either way, it's a fair chunk again. And you have to remember, every time an exam is done, the hospital loses $2,000 to $3,000 on that exam. It's not. So they don't see this as something they really want to get behind financially, right?
I guess I get a little troubled too when what we're doing is asking non-law enforcement professionals, they're definitely professionals, to keep track of law enforcement stuff. But then I'm also thinking about, like, I have one of my closest friends lives in Burns, Oregon, and, you know, how in the world would, you know, the state police even, you know, they're cruising through town, you know, once a month. Something to pick up evidence with. I mean, maybe more often than that.
We have a patrol office in Burns. It's not a robust office, but we have
one. I'm just saying. I mean,
but there are also ways that you have procedures in place to
get kits
from one hospital.
Yeah.
That just shows that every need is needed. I mean, we are thin in so many ways.
Yeah. I would not want my hospital hanging on to my kit for 60 days. It's evidence.
It sounds, I mean.
If I was the lawyer of the hospital, I wouldn't want you hanging on to the evidence for 60 days. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
So it sounds like there's a fix that maybe just right in front of us that we're not talking about, which is having dialogue between the hospitals and local law enforcement, where local law enforcement can help offset the cost of putting in some storage so that there are actual lockers that can be utilized for these kits. What you just said to me made me sit back almost. I mean, it was bothersome to me to think that we'd have so much access to a safe kit that now creates a contamination that makes it impossible to move forward, or at least opens up a whole lot of arguments. So it seems to me that there might be some fix there where law enforcement and the hospital communities can work together to create some kind of storage. As for the medical records, I think that's a much longer discussion about people's interpretation of HIPAA, and when somebody signs off, they're willing to allow somebody to have access, why that paperwork can't go with the kit. That's a much deeper conversation. But and I don't want to drag this out. You're probably tired of hearing from me, too.
Sounds like an agenda item number 2 at the leadership conference November 2nd, to have a conversation about just what you said, together with this notion, should the law read 7 days, or should we be open to this modification like we did here a little bit ago? Not that we want to go back all the time to Melissa's Law and keep changing everything, but we ought to try and think of all the changes at once, and this might be one of them, right?
And as soon as it's practicable, good enough, though, maybe?
Well,
you have to have an outset. I think if you say as soon as practicable, but no longer than 7 days, then you're building in that. I mean, there's that the rural agencies, it may be difficult to get to them within 4 to 24 hours. So when we make a recommendation, that recommendation will show up someplace when it's not adhered to, and it's going to bite some people pretty firmly. Mm-hmm. So if we can work on something that can help offset the concern of contamination or those issues, and not put that storage on the backs of hospitals, then maybe that becomes a workable resolution where we then take care of the concerns of
that seems reasonable.
The task force as well.
Yeah, that seems reasonable.
And I think the CERTs have a big play in that. So we get the SANE and the law enforcement and everybody coming up with what works in their community. Mm-hmm. And that.
Okay, any further discussion on that? So with that, let's talk about our next steps. Is that mine or yours? Okay.
I'm happy to do it.
No, I'm okay. So Melissa's Law, the task force is directed to complete 6 specific duties before July 31st, 2018 and submit a report to the Judiciary Committee before December 1st, 2018. Please keep those deadlines in mind as we think about our next steps. And note that the task force is currently scheduled to be repealed on June 30th, 2019. And your favorite thing is save the date. The next scheduled task force days are on November 16th and January 9th. Please save those dates as it is likely that the task force will meet then. And I'll work with Josh. We'll try to pin those down a little closer to you about the times that we will have available to meet. Invitation to the hospitals. We'll invite representatives from hospitals to one or both of the next meetings so that the task force can hear their perspective and consider ways to partner with the industry to provide more comprehensive care to victims of sexual assault. Membership, we continue to have 2 vacancies on the task force, 1 seat for a person with experience seeking and applying for grants and other private funding, and 1 seat for a person representing law enforcement agencies located in rural jurisdictions. If you're aware of anyone who would be interested, let us know, and we'll pass it along to the appointing authority, which is the governor's office. And previously identified next steps. Session interrupted work on 2 of the 3 previously identified next steps. While the definition of anonymous kit in Melissa's Law was successfully amended this session, the 2 remaining issues that task force has expressed an interest in working on are the creation of an informational card that law enforcement can hand to sexual assault nurse examiners or victims, and exploring additional training and cross-training opportunities. Any questions or comments on those, and any other ideas for potential next steps? Oh, I like the silence. Excellent. So with that, it is always a pleasure to be here at this dais and to continue to learn about really important things. And so I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and I will close the meeting. We are adjourned. And I will close the